Let's open our Bibles to Deuteronomy chapter number 25. Verse 17 is our starting point today. Remember that Moses is giving all this information on the 11th month of the 40th year of the Exodus, and he wants the Israelis who are about to go into the Promised Land to know what their responsibilities are after he's gone and they are moving forward into God's land. And one of the things that they have got to take care of at some point in the future is dealing with the Amalekites who tried to wipe them out or mistreat them or misuse them. And this is what God tells them through Moses. 25:17. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt. The Amalekites, by this time in their history, had turned into kidnapping slave traders. And they saw a whole bunch of former slaves as a perfect market opportunity and tried to attack them and take the best of them to put onto the slave market. But God did not allow that to happen. They were defeated. And God told them, though, at some point in the future, it's going to be so bad with the Amalekites that I will need you as my actors, as my representatives, to completely take them out of the picture. So verse 18, how he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary, cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind you, and he did not fear God. Therefore, when he who is your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you, in the land that he who is your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. So once they get into the Promised Land and settled, so we're talking only a few years, that's when they were supposed to take out Amalek. But they don't, because they don't do things God's way once they're in the Promised Land, and they end up with this whole period that we're calling the period of the judges. And it's not a good period for the most part. As the book of Judges says, in those years there was no king in Israel, and everyone did as they saw fit in their own eyes. So basically, they just did what they felt like, and it wasn't a good thing. So it won't be until the beginning of the kingdom period when Saul is told to get this job done, and he won't get it done. David will do better at it, but unfortunately because of what Saul did, there will be Amalekites that survive into the future. And the most famous Amalekite that caused the Israelis problems in the future is in the book of Esther, where Haman, the Agagite, which means he was a direct descendant of the king Agag of the Amalekites in the time of Saul, he tries to completely annihilate the Jewish race. And that is the consequences of not following through with what God tells you to do when he tells you to do it. There are consequences. All right, now into Deuteronomy chapter 26, verse 1. Change of topic. When you come into the land that he who is your God is giving you for an inheritance, and have taken possession of it, and live in it, you shall take some of the first of all the fruit of the ground, which you harvest from your land that he who is your God is giving you. You shall put it in a basket. You shall go to the place that he who is your God will choose to make his name to dwell there. And you shall go to the priest who is in office at that time and say to him, I declare today before he who is your God that I have come into the land that he who is swore to our fathers to give us. So effectively, we're seeing here the tithing ceremony. that takes place around the time of the Feast of Tabernacles every year. That's in the fall. It's at the end of the cycle of produce. So each head of the household was supposed to take a representative basket of produce to the high priest at the tabernacle and say, I'm in the promised land where God told me I would be, and here is a representative sample of all that he's blessed me with that I am giving back as an offering to him for keeping his promises. Verse 4, then the priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of he who is your God. And you shall make response before he who is your God. So this is, again, remember, a ceremony of significant historical connection. And part of it is to remember your history, remember the past, and to be able to recount it. We know that this is the truth of our own situation. We even have a saying, those who fail to learn from history's mistakes are doomed to repeat them. So a people who does not know their history are a people too easily conned into giving up, giving in to the demands of others who would rule over them. So this is why all of us as citizens should know our history well. This is why all of us as Christians should know our Bible history well. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul tells his readers that these things were written down for your benefit so that you could see what happened and not do the same things. So the written word of God, which we go over together as part of this study time, it's why I try to go through the entire Bible every 4.5 years this fashion. This study of the past actions is to help us know how God has worked in the past and have confidence that he will work with us to our benefit. All right, so that's my appeal. Everybody needs to love history. Here is the historical knowledge base that every Israeli was supposed to say each year as they gave their tithe. A wandering Aramean was my father. So we're talking about Abraham's family. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, who becomes Israel, which then becomes the nation of Israel. So this is the family story here. Abraham started in Aram, in Syria. And so Abraham is the father. He went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. That would be Jacob, Israel, who takes his family of 72 named men, including some that were already down in Egypt. And they go down and they start living in Egypt. We saw that from the book of Genesis. There he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. So the nation of Israel grows out of the family of Israel. The Egyptians treated us harshly and humiliated us and laid on us hard labor. That's the transition from the book of Genesis into the book of Exodus. Then we cried out to he who is the God of our fathers, and he who has heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. And he who has brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great deeds of terror, with signs and wonders. And so that's the whole story of the Exodus, the 10 plagues, the Passover, the departure, the crossing of the Red Sea, the feeding with the manna, the giving of the miraculous water from the rock, all of that. is part of this history that you're supposed to know each year as an Israeli when you're giving your gift of tithing to the Lord. He brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. You know, a very prosperous place. And behold, now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground, which you, oh, he who is, has given me. So I am giving you this tithe, this tenth of my produce for the year. I'm giving you the first tenth of the produce of my property as my way of acknowledging you keep your promises. Then you shall set it down before he who is your God and worship before he who is your God. And you shall rejoice in all the good that he who is your God has given you and to your house, you and the Levite and the sojourner who is among you. And we've talked about this before. Feast of Tabernacles, the tithing time. The tithe was actually used in the celebratory meals for your family and the Levites who lived in your towns because they didn't have their own region of the Promised Land to live in. They were a tribe that was serving God among the people. So you always made sure that you invited the Levites to be part of your own celebrations at this time of year. And anybody that was visiting in the country, because anybody that was coming to the land of Israel more than likely would have at least some interest in God, the Lord, he who is. And you wanted them to enjoy his blessings poured out upon you as part of your reaching out to them with an invitation that they should embrace he who is as their Lord and God. So this is a description, a very good description of the ceremony, heavy on history, that was supposed to happen at the Feast of Tabernacles every year in conjunction with the feasting. Now, we shared before that at the end of the Feast of Tabernacles, the rest of the tithe, which would be the majority of it that was left, would then be given to the Levites for their yearly support. And they would then give a tenth of their tithe to the priests as their yearly support. Some of it would also be stored at the tabernacle, later at the temple, to help poorer people get through rough times. So that feeds into the next passage, which I hope I can explain again to help you see the logistics of how the tithing system worked. Verse 12. When you have finished paying all the tithe of your produce in the third year, which is the year of tithing, giving it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your towns and be filled. Now notice my emphasis upon the idea of in your towns, because the tithing system worked in this fashion. The Israelis had a seven-year cycle that they went through. 6 years of work, followed by a seventh year of rest for everybody from their normal agricultural animal keeping procedures, okay? The way that those 6 years of work fed into the tithing program was this. In years one and two, and years four and five, you took the entirety of your tithe to the central worship site. All of it. Your whole tithe. You did your special week-long celebrations with your family, your friends, your local Levites and priests, and with any of the sojourners. And then what remained of your tithe at the end of the Feast of Tabernacles was left at the central worship site and put into storage by the Levites and the priests. That's in years 1, 2, 4, 5. In the third year, which is mentioned here, and in the sixth year, which would be another third year, you would only take your representative sample to the central location, the little basket that you're talking about here, and whatever it is you anticipated that you would use in the feasting part of your tithing ceremony at the Feast of Tabernacles. And you would go through your normal procedures for that. The bulk of your tithe, though, was to be kept in the local storehouses of your towns and your region. That's what it's saying here. So that your local Levites, your local priests, and your people that might have fallen on hard times would have storage of material that could be dipped into to support them. So that's the concept. Years 1, 2, 4, 5 goes to the central location. Years 3 and 6 go to the local storehouses. And year 7, everybody enjoys the free production of the land and the animals as the year progresses. All right, so in year number 3, once you've put the tithe into the local storage, and then you go with your representative sample and your celebratory portion to the centralized location to worship, when you've done all that, then you go through this ceremony, verse 13. Then you shall say before He who is your God, I have removed the sacred portion out of my house, and moreover, I have given it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandment that you have commanded me. I have not transgressed any of your commandments, nor have I forgotten them. So effectively, you tell God, and also the priests and Levites at the central location, I have removed my tithe into the local storehouses in this particular year. I didn't bring it here because it's the third or the sixth year. I put it into the local one. Verse 14 continues. I have not eaten of the tithe while I was mourning, or removed any of it while I was unclean, or offered any of it to the dead. I have obeyed the voice of He who is my God. I have done according to all that you have commanded me. So any of the portion that he legitimately could eat at the Feast of Tabernacles, he ate it in a clean state. He did it in a worshipful manner. That's what he's saying here. So he has followed all procedures in this, the third or the sixth year. And then he asks for the blessing. Verse 15, look down from your holy habitation from heaven and bless your people Israel and the ground that you have given us as you swore to our fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey. So all of this was to get to this verse, to show that you have to bless God first before you ask God to bless you. And that is definitely a lesson that Christians in our modern era need to understand. God needs to be blessed by us, meaning we need to do things His way before we ever ask Him to bless us. And we need to be better at that adherence to the holy standard of life and never expect that he should bless us without us blessing him. That's why I really loved it when I saw for the very first time someone posting this. God bless America as America blesses God. So there is this reciprocal relationship that needs to be going on, and it's shown here in the Israeli law. All right, verse number 16. Moses continues, "This day, he who is your God commands you to do these statutes and rules. You shall therefore be careful to do them with all your heart and with all your soul. You have declared today that he who is your God, and that you will walk in his ways and keep his statutes and his commandments and his rules and will obey his voice. And he who is has declared today that you are a people for his treasured possession, as he has promised you, and you are to keep all his commandments, and that he will set you up in praise and in fame and in honor high above all nations that he has made, and that you shall be a people holy to he who is your God, as he promised." So once again, Moses lays it out here very plainly. It is a reciprocal relationship. God will bless the Israelis as the Israelis bless God by obedience to the covenant, by living the holy lifestyle. And that should be understood to be true if the opposite happens. If the people of Israel do not bless God, do not obey his covenant, then God is under zero obligation to bless them. In fact, as we are about to see, he will warn them that he will curse them for not doing according to everything that they've promised to do in this relationship. Chapter 27, this is the second time that a ceremony is described that will take place once the Israelis arrive in the Promised Land. And it is a ceremony that needs to take place at an ancient holy site. It is the first worship site that Jacob, who becomes Israel, set up once he arrived back in the Promised Land from Syria, from Aram. It is at the place called Shechem, or Shoulders. And it sits between two mountains. The mountains are actually the shoulders of Shechem. That's the best way to think of it. And you can look them up in an encyclopedia and find out where they're at. You can locate them on mapping programs like Google Earth and see exactly where they're at. So this is the commandment. "Now Moses and the elders of Israel commanded the people, saying, 'Keep the whole commandment that I command you today, and on the day you cross over the Jordan to the land that he who is your God is giving you, you shall set up large stones and plaster them with plaster, and you shall write on them all the words of this law when you cross over to enter the land that he who is your God is giving you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as he who is the God of your fathers has promised you. When you've crossed over the Jordan, you shall set up these stones concerning which I command you today on Mount Ebal, and you shall plaster them with plaster. And there you shall build an altar to he who is your God, an altar of stones. You shall wield no iron tool on them. You shall build an altar to he who is your God of uncut stones, and you shall build offer burnt offerings on it to he who is your God, and you shall sacrifice peace offerings and shall eat there, and you shall rejoice before he who is your God, and you shall write on the stones all the words of this law very plainly." So once they get into the Promised Land, at some point, as soon as it is possible, they are to make their way to the relatively geographic center of the Promised Land at Shechem. and they are to go to an ancient worship site of Jacob, their forefather. This worship site is on the slopes of Ebal, which is the northern of the two mountains. It's slightly taller by a few hundred feet than its twin to the south, which is Gerizim. And they are to raise up stones, presumably flat stones, and they are to put plaster on these stones and then either etch into it or use some sort of inking process to write out what I believe is the entire book of Deuteronomy. Now, some people think it's only the Ten Commandments. Others think it might be all of the books of Moses from Genesis up through Deuteronomy. I, at this point in my ministry, think it's probably just Moses' second law, the book of Deuteronomy. And so it is to be written out on all this series of stones as the first monument to the covenant in the Promised Land. It will be a place where people can come on a regular basis and read for themselves the Word of God given through the prophet Moses to the people of Israel going into the Promised Land. It will be the shrine of the covenant. And this will play an important part in later Israeli history that I'll come back to. But this highlights once again the importance of the written word and how very early on these things that we're reading today were in written form. They were written almost instantaneously so that they could be passed on from generation to generation. We have come to the end of our time for this morning, so we will come back tomorrow and talk about the blessing and curse ceremony that will follow up the putting up of God's written word.